This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 11th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is Data of Comparable Magnitude, Part 1. This lecture is 58 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Want to talk to you this morning about comparable confusions. It's a very funny thing to be talking about confusions. Confusions of comparable magnitude. Quite interesting, fascinating. We know in the logics of the earliest logics that a datum can only be measured by data of comparable magnitude. We think this over for a moment. This is very true. We cannot even get time without two particles. It's not possible. A particle sitting all by itself in a bit of space does not move. As soon as we consider the space to have anchor points, which are live, solid, visible anchor points, of course we could consider this particle to have motion. But if we just consider space as space and without any dimension, we cannot have motion with just one single particle. Why? Why is this? It's because there's nothing to move in relation to. There's not a possibility here at all of perceiving motion. This particle could actually be going in wide circles. It could be jumping up and down or doing almost anything. But the truth of the matter is there would be no other influence to interact with it, and so it would not have observable motion, and so it would not be in motion, and so there would be no time. Now, this is the formula of the only one. An only one is a person without a person of comparable magnitude, in his opinion. So therefore, he has no time, and he jams on the track. Well, that's the end of that lecture. You should get that, though. Unless we have an interaction between and amongst two or more particles, we have no time. And unless we have, in the upper echelons of thought, a datum of comparable magnitude, we cannot evaluate a datum. So therefore, any datum standing by itself remains unevaluated. Thus we find all patterns of logic and thought to consist of one of two things, either a well-aligned series of data of comparable magnitude or a confusion. You pay your money, it takes your chance. You're going to get one of the two. Now, logic is a parade of data of comparable magnitude. Even though datum 81, or a billion 81, and datum 1 may be widely different in magnitude, the first datum and the last datum in a chain of logic may be incomparable. One may be tiny, one may be huge. One may be of vast importance, the other may be of very petty importance. Here's the problem. A gradient scale draws between them a sequence of data, and any datum there, compared to the datum to the right of it and to the left of it, you might say, to give the thing direction, would be comparable to the datum. And then we would have an orderly parade of logic. Datum 1 would be huge. Datum 2 is comparable, not identical, but just comparable. It's maybe not quite as large, but almost. And datum 3, not quite as large as datum 2. Datum 4, not quite as large by some infinitesimal difference from datum 3. And so we would go on down the line. We could have 10,000 data, we would wind up at the 10,000th datum and find out it was microscopic, and the first datum was the size of the Empire State Building, yet these two data would be, we say, related. Therefore, a gnat could be considered abruptly a datum of comparable magnitude to the Empire State Building. One is standing still, the other is hopping about and flying around. One has enormous weight, the other has very tiny weight. We look at these two data, and we say, these two data are not of comparable magnitude. And that is the end of that, and we don't believe it. And somebody comes along and very slippily says, yes, they are too of comparable magnitude. Now, you take the datum immediately adjacent to datum 10,000, 9,999th datum, and we see that it is a fairly big gnat. And the 10,000th one was just a gnat, you know. And the 9,998th datum is an extraordinarily large gnat. Get the idea? And we just move back up those 10,000 data and we find the Empire State Building. Got it? Here we have it. Then, data of comparable magnitude between a gnat and the Empire State Building. And this is a trick called logic. And the favorite trick of mathematics. Mathematics is always taking a one, which is not quite as big as another one, and saying they equal two. And flunking out little school children, if they won't immediately swear on a stack of Bibles it's two, and machine gunning them down and telling them you're going to go home and your parents are going to throw you out in the street because you're failing in school, because you're a dummy and a dunce, you're not pleasing anybody. And if you don't see that those two ones are exactly alike, we are just going to grind you to the last inch of your beingness. In fact, everybody's going to be unhappy with you, going to make you unpopular in class, we're going to sneer at you. We're going to use any mechanism we have at our command to make you assume that 1 plus 1 equals 2. Why all this? Well, because the thetan just doesn't take naturally to it, that's all. He can do it, he can do anything. But it's an unnatural thing to do. To say a gnat is like the Empire State Building. A philosophic machine is a machine which handily and without much trouble makes a gnat and an Empire State Building data of comparable magnitude. Now, actually, you have to get right down and work to make a person assume these illogics. But the way the trick is done, at which moment it becomes undone as a trick and logic becomes much more usable, since you can recognize what it is the fact you've got the gnat here, and then just by gradient scale, you just got the Empire State Building over here very nicely. And so that we take any two data in that chain, it would be difficult to detect which one was the larger datum. Follow me? All right, now let's take a chain of confusions. Confusion. What is confusion? A confusion is a bunch of I don't knows that are solidified into particles that are going no place but traveling awfully fast to get there. A confusion is something that's sitting awfully still when it should have been 1,000 light years away by this time. Either one is a confusion. A confusion is a person who should be there but is missing. Get the idea? A confusion, then, is any misalignment of data or postulates. So let's take this scale, and now let's just place them all at random. And then insist that this gnat and this Empire State Building are exactly the same. Same weight, same color, same temperature. And somebody says, but they're not. Everybody says, oh, yes, they are. Yes, they are. No. No getting around it. These two are exactly the same. Why are they exactly the same? Well, it says it in a book by Euclides. It does. It says, yes, it says right there in a book by Euclides that gnats and Empire State Buildings are data of comparable magnitude and are exactly the same size, weight, color, complexion, race, creed, and dedication. So they both have the same motives and intentions in life. They're both used for the same thing. And what he says, that is confusing. Why is it confusing? By a system of gradients, it would be possible to draw a concatenation here. You might call it that, this gradient. Empire State Building, next to that is a datum, almost the Empire State Building. Datum next to that, almost that second datum next to that, almost that third datum next to that, almost that fourth datum. And the next thing you know, we've got a gnat over here at datum 10,000. And Euclides did this. He was a very smart Greek. He was a very original Greek who had picked up all of his information in Egypt. He studied very well and came home and wrote the original thesis on the subject. It's quite amusing. I heard the other day that the Egyptians went over and studied under Pythagoras. That was a new one to me. Pythagoras studied under some fellows who studied with some Arabians. So it got their dope firsthand from the Babylonians, who borrowed their science from the Chaldeans. And we had then a series of data coming on down the line. Pythagoras used geometry and numbers and an Arabic number system to tell fortunes. And it became very popular in Greece, and that was where we got numerology. And this all proves that you shouldn't build pyramids. Well, it does. Now, you actually could string those apparently disrelated data together in such a way as to demonstrate to somebody that you should not construct pyramids. Oh, you could do the darndest things with it. You could say, well, shortly after the invention of geometry in the Nile Valley, shortly after that, the Babylonians were found to have had a hand in it. That still isn't arcing exactly right, is it? Geometry is invented by people who live in river valleys which overflow. That's pretty good, isn't it? Chaldea was near the Euphrates, and so was Babylonia, and so the Euphrates is a river of comparable magnitude to the Nile. These rivers are quite similar. And the similarity of these rivers are very striking. In fact, they are so striking that they both overflowed. And overflowing, they deposited vast quantities of silt on their banks. And they tore up land markings, both the Euphrates and the Nile. Tore up all of the landmarks, so that every year a bunch of surveyors had to go out to survey everybody's fields. Sounds awfully good so far, isn't it? Now, therefore, gradually there in the Nile, they picked up the information which had leaked through from Chaldea and picked this up and reorganized geometry, more or less on the lines that had been followed by the Chaldeans. Sounds logical, doesn't it? It's all hanging together very nicely, isn't it? And later, one could then expect these things to be employed, these geometric patterns, to be employed in solids. And demonstrations of these became so common in Egypt that they built the pyramids. This is sort of going along smoothly, isn't it? However, pyramids were much earlier constructed in the Euphrates Valley. However, we can see clearly that the Euphrates Valley was destroyed by erosion. Instead of building various dikes and instead of planting in such a way as to prevent erosion in the Euphrates Valley, the labor available was used to build these huge monuments. So that the science of geometry, to a large degree, backfired, and the labor of the area was totally absorbed into the construction of these huge monuments. And we saw Chaldea go by the boards. That's obvious. Chaldea has been by the boards for some time. It's gone. Valleys are all eroded. The Chaldean priests set up in Babylon and built these huge areas in Babylon, and again, draining the labor from the land to put them into these huge towers and geometric patterns, which were solids. And so, naturally, this also happened in Egypt. And therefore, we can see plainly that the pyramids never should have been built. We can demonstrate almost anything from anything. None of this happens to be true. It's merely logical. Why is it logical? Because we're associating data of more or less comparable magnitude, and I'm associating it poorly enough so that you can see the holes in it. But it needn't be. We could write one of the most learned treatises, which we discussed for the longest period of time down at the Royal Society of Blockbusters or something, to demonstrate conclusively that the downfall of all nations is geometry. That if geometry weren't invented by any nation, nations would be alive today. But this is more fitting an essay for a schoolboy who's been being made to study geometry. Now, geometry is one of the more vicious mathematics because it doesn't know too much about this subject of mathematics. Geometry is a sort of a stupid mathematics. It takes all of these things and then assumes more from them than anybody should possibly assume. It says side angle side. You know, one triangle equals another triangle because the two sides in the angle are equal to the two sides in the angle. No. Nobody ever invented a mathematical instrument precise enough to draw two angles which were exactly alike. And two triangles existing in two different spaces are never equal. Never till the end of time. We would have to assume a tremendous number of data to get these things equal. We would have to assume their surroundings, the quality of the paper they were drawn on, the ink quality, its manufacture, the ability of the individual to exactly duplicate an angle, the reliability of a pen in not making 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter more line in one triangle than the other. I mean, just go on just the imperfections of drawing, and we discover immediately the thing is theoretical and not actual at all. And furthermore, they exist in two different spaces, and they probably have two different intentions or purposes. But aside from this, they're equal. They are, at best, data of comparable magnitude. And the thing that we must disentangle with the preclear is this. We can have data of comparable magnitude on any gradient scale that we want. Quite important. We can have data of comparable magnitude. We can say anything is comparable to anything and thereby get logic. And the other thing we must disentangle with the preclear is an identification of any two of these data. And upon that depends, to a large degree, his sanity. At no time do we discover data A exactly data B. We must preserve a certain ability to differentiate between these two exact data. An ability to differentiate between one and another one. Even though they're standing there in an equation, we say one what? plus one what equals two what? And you say, well, one apple plus one apple equals two apples. Oh, no. That is not true. You just work it around for a while, and you'll see that this is wrong, because you transfer one one on the other side of the equation, and you get one apple equals one apple, and this has not existed since the beginning of time. If we take two apples off of a tree, to our naked eye, they are different. So the moment we apply the beauties of theoretical mathematics to the physical universe, they go poof. Now we see that equalities consist then of considerations. The differences consist of considerations. And all mathematics teaches us is it's possible to consider anything. Just like that, you can consider anything, to be anything. It's only when an individual believes these considerations are the truth that he gets into difficulty. He says, all women are alike. That's an interesting identification, isn't it? You could say, all these alphas are alike, as a mathematician. And then prove it to somebody, and he would be very happy about the whole thing. All alphas used in all mathematics are alike. Well, you haven't yet made messed out of it, so therefore, it is just a consideration. Now we say, if all alphas are alike, obviously all other names are alike. All Bettys are alike. All Marys are alike. And we get this fantastic panorama that all women are alike. See, it's not much of a drop from all alphas are alike to all women are alike. The one is logical, isn't it? So therefore, the other is logical too, isn't it? Obviously, I'm dealing with two data of comparable magnitude. A little mass is entered into it, that's about all. I've just proven to you mathematically that all women are alike. All alphas are alike, aren't they? Now, in the textbooks of nuclear physicists, we have a symbol called C, which is the stable datum of nuclear physics, and which, if removed, would destroy all of nuclear physics, and there wouldn't even be a poof when they set off a plutonium bomb. See, if we just took that stable datum away from them and hid it someplace, that would be the end of atomic fission. We're going to organize a society inside of another society for the eradication of the constant C. C stands for the speed of light. And we have discovered that C is not constant. In fact, we've discovered enough things about C that one night I was talking nuclear physics, he's got kind of green. First he got kind of sneery, you know. I was attacking his prime god, C, the common denominator, the stable datum. And he got kind of green before I got through with him. I demonstrated to him conclusively he didn't know a damn thing about C. I said, all right. Now, electricity can be packed in to a condenser of no resistance, can't it? Oh, and the guy says, I never heard of such a thing. And I said, well, you better get up to date in nuclear physics. We take something that is minus 270, or almost minus 270, not minus 273, we don't have to go that low. We take something that's 270 degrees minus centigrade, and we start pouring into it volts and amps. And we keep feeding it the juice, and we feed it more juice and more juice, and we find out it has an infinite capacity. And we could just keep pouring the juice to it, and pouring the juice to it, and pouring the juice to it. We can throw billions and billions and trillions and quadrillions of megavolts into this thing. And we keep packing it up, and more and more and more. This is known, you see. And now we take this thing, and we heat it up. You know what happens? It goes boom! And this, by the way, is one of the more interesting answers to the atom bomb. The atom bomb isn't the only bomb there is. There is the electronic bomb, which is a packed-up bomb of volts and amps poured into this minus 270 degrees centigrade, C. All right, another C. Now, They're both the same, though. They're both written the same way, Arabic numeral. The C for centigrade and the C for the speed of light. That's observable, isn't it? Well, now listen, why is that illogical and other gradients illogical? It's another consideration. They mean two different things. Well, we both write them C. All right. Now, do you realize the temperature of the space between here and the sun? You understand, we just demonstrated that an infinitely cold condenser can have juice poured into it, and then when warmed up, go boom. But we know the juice can be poured into this infinitely. It has no resistance. We have upset all characteristics of light. It's quite fascinating. Do you know the temperature of the space between here and the sun? The exact temperature of it, of those considerable distances? The exact temperature of it is minus 273 degrees centigrade, or thereabouts, unless you hold up something and heat it up. Now, don't get upset. But we have said that the light that is coming across that space is not traveling in linear distance. One of the conclusions that can be drawn. Now, what I've just told you is shocking enough to wreck the entire science of astronomy, to wreck the entire science of nuclear physics, and to put a complete end to the science of physics itself in the field of electronics and electricity. There goes your C datum. It's a good stable datum, wasn't it? Do you realize that a photon coming through the sun is running through minus 273 degrees? Electricity doesn't flow. Neither does a photon flow through minus 273 degrees centigrade. And yet everybody's been sitting around here for ages saying, well, these photons which flow out of the sun and hit Earth, they do. Let's go over this again. At the same temperature of solar system space, intergalactic space, and all other space, minus 273 degrees centigrade, we can take a condenser and we can pour unlimited quantities of electricity into the condenser. It will hold an infinite capacity of electricity because there is no motion at minus 273 degrees centigrade. Electronic motion doesn't occur at that temperature. We can actually do this other and prove it. All right, now you got that real good? Well, the temperature of space between here and the sun is minus 273 degrees centigrade. A photon doesn't move from the sun to Earth. Now, what I'm telling you is absolute fact. It doesn't move. There is no such thing as C, 186 or whatever odd thing it is, miles per second, speed of light. You see that? There might be this speed on a telegraph wire, which is room temperature. You might get that in testing it between helio mirrors or something and measuring the microseconds of relay and so forth. You might get 186,000. That's the way they tested it, by the way, right here on Earth, providing it was room temperature. But now that you take it down to 100 or 200, well, you could only have to take it down to about 200 C and you'd find the motion on it was gone. Well, astronomy is calculated on this figure. So the way they figured it out originally, a couple of guys got together and they said, well, when that binary occludes itself, why, we will then know the speed of light. And I had an astronomer one time. I took this in the university. I also got it explained to me in calculus class. It explained to me in surveying. It was also explained to me in nuclear physics, in atomic and molecular phenomena classes and so forth. And I never got it. I'll be frank. I wasn't a charlatan. I wasn't a slippery character like the rest of the students around there. I just sat there trying to get this through my skull. And they said, oh, yes, yes, I want to pass. That's what they were writing on their examination papers. So this is all understandable to me. Well, they could put it down, the figures down in sequence, but it didn't make sense about these two occulting or occluding binaries that went spinning around, and therefore C was 187,000 miles per second or whatever it is. They keep changing their mind on it recently, by the way. Yes, C has changed at least 2,000 or 3,000 miles per second in the last 2 or 3 years. They claim it's getting slower. This is real wild. Anyhow, I sat there like a good boy, and I kept asking, now, you explain it to me again. Now, these two stars went out, and you could tell at the moment they went out that the shadow of another star over here fell on that star, and that occluded that star, and the moment that went out, then when you saw the shadow and saw the position of the other star, then here on Earth, you measured this and then immediately calculated how far it was. Well, this is all very interesting, but how did you know how far apart those two stars were? Oh, you're going to flunk this course, Hubbard. It's the only answer I ever got. They had assumed a distance someplace in the problem, and nobody would admit it. It was the slipperiest piece of logic you ever saw in your life. They had assumed a distance way out there, and then had confirmed it, and then had calculated the speed of light from it. And I found nothing about this that was upsetting. I just assumed anybody would assume a distance and calculate a speed of light. I just as soon assume this, so on. But don't try to tell me it's true. I just soon they considered this. I've considered lots of things. I remember I was talking to a girl once when I was about 17, and, well, we won't go into that. Well, when somebody comes along with a bunch of phony data and says, this is truth, and you are going to swallow this, or we're going to swallow you, I'm reasonable about that, too. I'll wait till I'm halfway down their throats or something, and then I'll say, well, if you say so, or something on this order. But I don't have to believe it. Now, to this day, I've never believed this constant called C, and it is the fundamental constant of nuclear physics. Now, in quantum mechanics, they also have another thing that's quite interesting. This mathematics is an interesting mathematics. It is an exact mathematics, as all mathematics are. Except you have to add random numbers in all of its equations to make it come out right. Be on this order. One apple plus one apple plus 865 equals two apples. You say, all right. What's the 865? Well, you have to throw that in there so that the two apples will be two apples over here. Oh, come off now. Where did the 865 come from? Well, we put it there. Well, what does it represent? It doesn't represent anything. It's in there, so the equation will balance. Well, who dreamed it up? Well, we have just found out that we always have to throw 865 in there when we deal with apples. We deal with pineapples, we throw 162 in there. They say, oh, no. And you guys are building bombs? It's something on the order of how they figure out airplane propellers. It's the cutest thing you ever saw. Somebody takes a jackknife and he whittles a propeller. And he sets it up in a test mount and he tests its turbulences and its drift and drag and its LD ratio, and he gets it all straight, and he's got it all set now, and they balance it out and whittle a little bit more, and it's a nice propeller. Nothing wrong with it at all. Mathematician comes along, and he draws a formula that long, you know, clear down page after page after page. They've got the formula of this propeller. And then he sends this over to the factory, and he says, well, this is the propeller. And the mathematician over there writes down, figures it out, puts it all on a graph, takes various descriptive geometry pictures of this propeller, gets it all set and so forth, and turns it over to the metal shop. And he says, there's your propeller. And the metal shop says, gee, we're glad to have that. And one of the mechs in the metal shop goes over to the test lab and gets the wooden propeller. Because they're not the same propellers when you've looked at them via mathematics. And they never have been. They're not the same airfoils. That's why they have wind tunnels. And yet, in studying aeronautical engineering, you are always oppressed by having to express everything in a mathematical form. These curves may or may not be expressible in a mathematical form, but certainly the builders never use them. That's good enough for me. You get the idea? We've translated data of comparable magnitude, and they find it insufficiently comparable to construct airplanes that fly. First place, probably nobody knows why airplanes fly, but there's a lot of theory on the subject. When I was first studying this subject, they said there was the pressure on the bottom end of the wing. And when I next started to go into the subject a little time later, I found out it was the vacuum on top of the wing. And I'm willing at any moment to find out it's the heat on the leading edge. Any moment, I just soon find that out. There'll be another explanation for it. The point is, here's a piece of mess flying. There's also something very interesting is here on Earth, they can't build flying saucers yet. Some of us put our heads together over in Silver Spring the other day and invented the flying saucer. We found the law, which is the damnedest law. It's been lying there ever since. You'd be interested in this law. As mass approaches infinity, the force required to move it must approach zero. That's wrong. You know that in order to make that car out there move faster, you've got to put a heavier motor in it. Or is that right? Is there something wrong with that? To move a car faster, you have to put a heavier motor in it and burn heavier fuel. Have you noticed car motors getting more and more powerful and smaller and smaller? They're probably getting more and more powerful because they're getting smaller and smaller. I had a little British bike I used to take cross-country runs. It has an oversized sprocket, but it has 150 cubic centimeter motor. This is tiny. This is almost model airplane motor, you know. Little tiny thing. And it outruns by miles per hour, miles per gallon, and verticals and everything else, it outruns a Harley 45 cubic inch. Well, this is something like dropping a billiard ball in a can of coffee, you know. I mean, it's just that comparable size. You have a little tiny 150cc motor which is developing more horsepower, more usable and effective horsepower. But both bikes go about the same speed. This is very amazing. Now, theoretically, if you wanted the Harley Davidson motorcycle to go faster, you would have to put a bigger motor in it with more cubic capacitance, and then it would go faster. Except if you put one just a little bit bigger than that, it would probably fall to pieces because of the weight, and it wouldn't go faster. The actuality is the way you'd get the Harley to go faster is to put a smaller motor in it. This sounds incredible, but the rhythm and lightness of the stroke has a great deal to do with it. Cubic capacitance has very little to do with it. This is an actual fact. I mean, this Triumph Terrier, 150cc motor, in the U.S., in most of the road races and so forth, is running everybody down and running right over them. It's the tiniest motorcycle motor in existence. Well, I suppose there are smaller ones they put on James, but they're not motorcycle motors. They're bicycle motors. This is a fantastic thing, isn't it? One asks the question, why does an automobile motor run? We don't know. We do know this, that you can build one theoretically and put it on the test blocks, and it doesn't function the way it was supposed to function. I suppose it has something to do with the lightness and rhythm with which the molecules of gasoline or carbon or something are hitting the front wall of a cylinder, and the thrust and stroke probably has nothing to do with it. Could you see that there might be some weird factor at work in there? Because it is true and is demonstrable that you need lighter and more rhythmic force to drive larger bodies. One of the kids at Silver Spring got kind of upset one day. We were standing there and we were figuring this and we were saying, well, now, isn't that a funny thing? The physical universe exactly approximates a thetan. A thetan who uses postulates to move things and get things done, is touching very lightly, isn't he? And he really moves things around and gets things done. It's only when he gets in there and tries to force things around with energy masses that he doesn't get anything done. And all of a sudden, mechanics, the physical universe, began to approximate a theta. Because as the mass to be handled approaches infinity, the force required to move it must approach zero. And we move this far enough back, we get a theta. But a theta doesn't come from that mass. You understand? He's there, and he built up the mass. And as he departs from his ability to postulate, of course, this mess stuff departs from its ability to move. Anyway, Don and I were discussing this, and we got this all figured out. Got it figured out very nicely. And he said something like, well, I tell you, Don, you go down to the South Pole, and I'll go up to the North Pole. And you make a postulate in this direction against the South Pole, and I'll make a postulate in this direction, North Pole, and we will just straighten Earth up on its axis very nicely. And Bill was so deep into this, he says, oh, no, you don't. He said, I like the seasons. But you would have to be an awfully light touch thetan to set Earth straight on its axis. And the trick in handling a body is to touch it lightly enough. As an individual gets lazy, unable to move around, unable to produce immediate force reactions, move boxes of matches, and all this kind of thing, as he is trying to do this, he is using, actually, more force than he needs if he can't do it. And we know this by experience. You have to be able to make a light enough postulate to get mass to do anything. Well, now, getting a matchbox to move is difficult, because it doesn't have enough mass in it to be moved easily. Sounds funny, but a Thetan would have difficulty moving it, whereas he might not have much difficulty moving a heavy oak table or a house or Earth. Now, when we get up to moving Earth, it's probably very easy to do. When we get up to moving the whole solar system and the sun, it's probably so easy that we don't dare think about it right now. We had a series of experiments, actual experiments, which seemed to demonstrate this basic law. And we are perfectly content to have holes in it and everything else. But I assure you that the society must be wrong with relationship to mechanics, since we have yet to have a good motor. We've got a lot of things that grunt and roar and so forth, but we don't have a good motor in this society yet. There must be something wrong then with the basic laws of mechanics. And the thing that is wrong with them is Newton's law of interaction. We discovered all this because Newton's law of interaction can be violated with great ease. You can drive something forward without paying any attention to Newton's law of interaction, get away with it. Newton's law of interaction depends on comparable magnitude. You only get interaction when you have a comparable magnitude of mass and rhythm. And when you have a very comparable magnitude of mass and rhythm, you get interaction. Now you wonder, where the devil I've been going with all this stuff? Well, we're describing aberration and confusions of comparable magnitude. Do you see that something would have a law which might be workable in a very finite band, but would not be workable outside a certain reality? Let's say that in Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, you can't spit. You'd get arrested if you spat. That's a law, isn't it? And we go outside the city limits and we find out we can spit without getting arrested. In other words, this law about spitting is good only in Birmingham, Alabama. Similarly, the law of interaction, for every action there is an equal and contrary reaction. That is Newton's law. And that is only valid in a very thin limit. And is only valid with regard to masses of equal rhythm and magnitude. We only get an interplay when we have a similarity of mass and wavelength. Now, that's important. The interaction, then, between the gnat and the Empire State Building is darn poor. We start to move the Empire State Building to the right, and Newton's law of interaction says it will promptly move back against us to the left with the same force that we moved it to the right. You know? For every action, there's an equal and contrary reaction. Not true. It couldn't be true. Now, actually, we could stand there and kick the Empire State Building rhythmically in a certain way, and it would fall down. Just as Caruso could sing a note and break up a glass. There was not much force in his singing. But glasses broke because they got into resonance and vibration. You can explain this very easily. Well, resonance and vibration has something to do with this. The wind moves the Empire State Building all over the sky. Also, it moves the Washington Monument. Now, don't tell me the number of pounds of pressure in the wind is actually sufficient to wobble this thing on its foundation. Oh, well, you see, that's constant pressure. Well, it isn't constant pressure. It goes whip, 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 whip. And we figure all this out and how much it is, and it becomes illogical. Now, I'll show you how idiotic this is. Do you realize that if you stamp on the ground that Earth moves back against your foot, you actually displace Earth and it moves back against your foot when you stamp? Do you realize that? When you stamp on the ground, Earth moves to that degree out of position and moves back against your foot to that degree. Did you know that? Oh, you guys are out of agreement with the physicists. Do you realize every time you try to move something, it kicks back against you? Do you realize everything pushes you as hard as you push it? You really don't agree with this, do you? Well, that's Newton's law of interaction. And it's the law used in finite physics and even in nuclear physics. It's a basic law of physics. And it says immediately, nothing can be done about anything anywhere, so we may as well all quit. If Newton's law of interaction were 100% true, there would never be anything capable of putting anything else in motion. So it must be some kind of a modified statement and probably not a law at all. You know where it comes from? Thetans make considerations about morality. They say, in this society, if I do anything to you, it will be the same as happening to me. And we get the Christian impulse of do unto others as they you would have them do unto you. These are all consideration level laws of interaction, see? On the physical plane, we get this silly law of interaction. We get these other things. Now, everything you do to everybody then has to be done to you. You're walking through a crowd, you jostle somebody, therefore you have to be jostled as you go up the street by somebody else. Otherwise, it isn't equal and balanced. It's not true. You'd go crazy if you tried to follow that law all the time. You know that? You would go mad. Be no hope for it. But the law is true when you have two masses which are almost exactly the same masses. They are of comparable magnitude. When a billiard ball hits a billiard ball, the billiard ball doing the hitting imparts some of its motion to the second billiard ball. But it itself stops or kicks back. Isn't that right? Well, if we've got a couple of billiard balls, they'll interact. But other data don't. Just because you throw a billiard ball down the length of a billiard table is no reason why the billiard table moves. Did you ever notice a billiard table move because you moved a billiard ball? Well, Newton's law of interaction, without any modification, states the billiard table moves. We've never observed that, so it's not true. And it doesn't happen to be true either. And it's the stumbling block of physics. You follow me? This universe requires two data to have time, two particles to have time. To have an opinion about any datum requires another datum. To evaluate any data, you have to have two data or more. You can't evaluate one datum. You can't understand one datum. That's the only datum there is. There is no other datum comparable to this datum. And you won't understand it. When they get a hold of God, they invent the devil, so you can understand how good God is and how bad the devil is. Those are two data of comparable magnitude. Christianity talks then all the time about monodeism and gives us two gods. Most fantastic piece of illogic that just makes your brains go creak. Nobody could possibly understand God unless he understood the devil. But he understands the devil by understanding God. Now, nobody could understand the devil or God unless both God and the devil existed. Do you understand? He could walk up to a datum, and the datum was whoop. See? And he'd say, well, this datum, whoop. Now, I have the opinion, no. In order to get an evaluation, he would have to give an opinion of equal magnitude to the data. But now he's got two data. And then he'll go on evaluating this other datum with regard to his world. See that? There's a datum there, whoop. He puts in whoa. And then thinks he understands this primary datum, whoop. All right, he walks up to a jelly bean. He's never seen a jelly bean before. There's not two jelly beans, there's just one jelly bean sitting there all by itself, disrelated to anything he's ever seen, he thinks. So he says, say, what is this? What is the purpose of this jelly bean? What is this thing? Smaller than I am, I'm not a datum of comparable magnitude to it. There's nothing else around here, its size, shape. Well, do you know that that looks like a grub worm? He just thought of one thing. A white jelly bean and a grub worm. Now he has two data, and he goes off and explains to somebody that sometimes grub worms petrify. And he has understood the jelly bean. It's no understanding. There are two jelly beans there. Actually, there was a better possibility of understanding them. Why was there a better possibility of understanding them? Well, they'd have to be of comparable magnitude. They couldn't be the same jelly bean. You couldn't have the same jelly bean there twice. If you had the same jelly bean there twice, you would never understand the jelly beans. So what you'd have to do is realize that some jelly beans are a little larger than other jelly beans, and some are a different color than other jelly beans. And now we can start describing these jelly beans. And we might be able to get it down along the line to a point where we had an understanding of the subject of jelly bean. But if the thing was there twice, it couldn't be compared to itself, by itself. It has to be compared from a slight difference. So it has to be comparable. It has to be similar. It cannot be identical. Hence, identities make no logic. To have logic, to have understanding, you have to have data of comparable magnitude. And this wise, you get time. You get time because two data can move in relationship to each other, and you can still tell them apart slightly. And so you know how the time is going, you see? In other words, to understand anything, you have to have a datum of comparable magnitude. And this is the entire subject of n-gram re-stimulation. An n-gram goes into re-stimulation by your effort to understand something you observe in the environment which does not have a second datum next to it. You see a post, you get an n-gram of a post, and now between the two, you understand the post you saw. You understand that? See what an n-gram could be for? People use this and use this and use this, and this is re-stimulation. On a higher plane, it is logic. In order to resolve a confusion, then, it is necessary to conceive confusions of comparable magnitude. To understand a post, a dog, a formula, anything, you have to have formula of comparable magnitude. To understand a man, you have to have men of comparable magnitude. You see this? and in order to process any manifestation, you had better have a manifestation of comparable magnitude, or get the preclear to invent one. And in view of the fact that the hardest single item to understand is a confusion, therefore, to understand the confusion, you have to have confusions of comparable magnitude, which is the thirst of individuals for confusions. When they don't have confusions enough, they can't understand confusion, therefore they start to do confusions of comparable magnitude in order to have enough confusions in order to make confusions as is. Now, this is the business of match terminals. Two terminals similar discharge one against the other, and you can understand them. One terminal all by itself simply discharges against you, or discharges against nothing. Just stays there. Now, out of all the bric-a-brac which I've been giving you here, there's one thing I want you to keep very close on the subject, and that is to eradicate any condition, you must work with conditions of comparable magnitude. Don't work with one condition. Don't work with one bad leg. With one pre-clear only ever. You understand? Because you will never understand it or them. And in view of the fact the hardest thing to understand is a confusion, you can resolve confusions easily by getting confusions of comparable magnitude. The preclear will do this obsessively if you don't do it in processing. And this is the whole mechanism back of the apparent desire for problems. It's an effort to get problems of comparable magnitude to understand the problems you already have. This is used many ways in processing, as I will tell you. Thank you.